Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need in this room tonight will hear our speaker, and we will all be persuaded to say, if willing, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Now, tonight, Michael T. is going to introduce our speaker. So, come on up, Michael.
Hey, everybody, I'm Michael Tishnick. I'm an alcoholic. Diagnosed, it's not an escape clause. Carl's my sponsor, so I made good money made here, and I guess God does that thing to me. Carl was put in my life by God about 8 years ago, and I identified with him because he had anger issues. He's having, if I remember correctly, I think it was kind of blurry, that he was having a meltdown in his car. And I said, that's the person I need to talk to, because how does he deal with his anger without getting drunk or committing a felony? You know? And I said, and since then, he's been extremely supportive. He never interrogated me. He asked the correct questions at the right time. Never preached to me, suggested to me, gave me hugs when needed a hug. He was there when everybody else was running for cover. And if you didn't know me back then, you'd understand what I'm saying. You know, everybody was clearing out, and he was standing there, and it's just, he's faced horrendous difficulties. You know, his wife passed away, his job functioned, and he stands and he fights the battles when he knows on which ones to fight. You know, and I got nothing but deep love and admiration for the man. Got a lot of power, a lot of strength, a lot of wisdom. And experience comes from the strength. Strength comes from the experience. Carl, like
to... I'm Carl, I'm an alcoholic. And, feeling pretty humbled by what's just happened here. One, Tim asking me to share my story. Thank you, Tim. And Michael T., what you just said about me. I told Michael T., by the way, my sobriety is 4/18/89. I told Michael T. that he reminds me most closely of my best friend growing up. He was sharp. He was athletic. He was everything I wanted to be, and he was my best friend. And like him, I'd do anything for you, and I already know you'd do anything for me. Anyway, I'm also humbled by the power of this disease, alcoholism. From the stories that have been shared, personal stories around the early morning study group, before that Skyland, any group I go to, the way this disease wreaks havoc on a person's soul and the lives and the souls of everybody around them. And the disease ends up putting the blame on the person. That's the one that catches the blame, the shame, the guilt. But it's the freaking disease. It ain't the person. I'm also humbled by the power of this program. These simple words, they're just words up on the side of the wall. They were for me at one time. I didn't have a clue what they meant. They sounded pretty. I wasn't ready to work them. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. Like I said, I didn't know what the hell they meant. But I'm also humbled by not only the power of the program, but you people, your personal stories, the willingness to disclose the most intimate secrets, things you'd never share with, things that we'd take to our grave for the benefit of another alcoholic. That's a bond that, for me, I needed. And I can't experience in any other place but in these rooms or in front of another alcoholic. And lastly, I'm humbled by a power that is behind your sensitivity, a power that's within those principles, and a power that can eradicate the effects of this disease and actually transform a person into a beautiful, beautiful human being. And for those that are left around him, to transform their lives quite miraculously. Anyway, I better get into it. I'm finished now. By the way, I'm finishing up a bronchial infection, so if you hear me hacking or have to put something in a hanky, don't think it's nervousness. It's not. It's don't get nervous for me. I'll start with a joke. A lot of you may have heard it, but it really hits to the heart of this disease about never being enough. My brother lives up in Massachusetts. I'm a transplanted Yankee. The good news is I've been in the South for many more years than I was in the North, so I'm starting to become civilized. And I tell everybody I'm sober and I'm Southern by the grace of God. My brother is not an alcoholic, but he still deals with compulsivity. And that came from a lot of yelling in our family, not at Carl, but I was in close range of it. It was directed at my older brother because he was not performing. And my father was pretty much absent, and you'll hear a little later that's not criticism of my father. He had to deal with his own wounds, and his way of dealing with that was to be very civically active. And he's probably done more in the city he lived in, with about 80,000 people, than any other person I know, and he's been honored for that. And he loved his son. And when his son was in trouble, he came in. But my brother asked me before a couple nights ago, I said, "Now I'm going to be doing this story." And he said, "Well, feel free to share anything you want about me." And I said, "Well, I just needed to get connected, Craig." And he said, "Are you alcoholic because of what happened in the family?" And I stopped for a second. I said, "You know, Craig," I said, "I'm an alcoholic because from the first time I took a drink, a real drink at 16, the effect is what I needed a lot more of. I've never had that effect from anything or anybody that was that powerful. And over time, I couldn't get enough of it. Did the other things contribute? I don't know. I didn't get into it with him, but for me it's my chemistry and my abuse of alcohol that transformed my body into not that of a social drinker. It took me a while to realize that and accept it, and thank God for your people, your stories, and what helped me realize that I was an alcoholic. I grew up in a coastal fishing town called New Bedford in coastal Massachusetts. I guess it would be on the coast, predominantly where the fish are. And I had a wonderful childhood. The neighborhood, no offense to the girls here, or women, but it was predominantly a male neighborhood, a lot of boys, and this was before organized sports were just coming in. And I have wonderful memories because my father, you'll find that my father wasn't there a lot, but he stood up for his boys. My mother had been an only child and never been around a lot of her peers, and so just had a natural fear of life in general and how to raise her boys and everything. So my father basically let us go, particularly in the summertime, from I guess about 7 in the morning till he should be home by dinner time. That was the rule. And whether we were making make-up games of football or baseball, whatever the sport was, basketball, or we'd be in what we call the woods, and we'd take our hatchets and our bows and arrows and our daggers and everything else, and we were boys, and we created our own reality. It wasn't structured like it is today. Bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Wonderful. Anyway, you heard part about the other part of it, that there was yelling in the home, and that yelling at close range still affects me. It's a conditioned response. If it's directed at me, something berserk goes quickly. But anyway, to get into this thing... my best friend and I were 16, and we got invited up to UMass to with his older brother and our other best friend. And we went out to a country store, and we each bought a half. I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. The first drunk I had was at my brother's college. I was invited up there for the weekend. And these guys came in with a carton of different beverages, Southern Comfort, beer, different types of beer, and other things. I don't remember all of them. What I do remember is two things. One is they were already feeling it, and I wasn't. And I wanted to feel just like they did. And so I got off the beer and started hitting Southern Comfort and just pouring it down, and then whatever else was there. I also remember clinging to the athletic field fence, saying, "I want to die, and I'll never do this again. And I'll never do this again." I was deathly sick. And I didn't do it again until we went up to UMass, and we each bought a half pint of blackberry brandy, and we found this place to get off the road out in the country. They turned the lights out, and we started our drinking. And my best friend was right next to me in the back seat, and he got out of the car, and we figured he went out to take a pee. I'm going to have to move. He went out to take a pee. I want to make this real. It's real important for me to make this point that my chemistry was different from my buddies and the effect that it had on me. He got out, we thought he was going to take a pee, so they turned the high beams on him, and he wasn't taking a pee. He was French biting a tree, an oak tree. And I remember sitting there saying, "That's the way I want to feel, uninhibited." So I looked down. I had already finished my half pint, and there's Bobby's. He'd only drunk half of it. So I think Bobby doesn't need it. So I drank his before I felt it. And when I felt it, something miraculously happened. Not only did I feel loose as a goose, uninhibited for the first time in my life. Self-centered fear. That's the other part of my disease other than the alcohol. Self-centered fear. I never felt a part of any, even though I had great friends and everything, I didn't feel a part of it. Somebody gave out the program and my emotions didn't know how to follow them. The other thing that happened was I started to get real humorous. And they said, "Carl, we didn't know you could be so funny." So not only did the alcohol in my system reinforce me and make me uninhibited, but their comments did. I didn't drink every week from that, but as I became closer to the age of drinking, I would go out with his older brother and sometimes together. Bobby looked younger, so we had a problem. But we'd go out, and they wouldn't ask us for our licenses or anything, and we'd go out like a Friday night and toss them down. When I went to college, first 2 years I went out to Indiana. Next 2 years I transferred back as my girlfriend, fell in love, and she transferred back to Connecticut, and I transferred back to New England College up in New Hampshire so I could be closer to her. I actually broke up with her because I felt that I wasn't enough, that she would find somebody. You know, she transformed from somebody who was not really overweight, very, very well endowed. And when we formed the relationship, she started changing. She became a knockout. And I felt that somebody's going to find her, she's going to find out there's a lot better fishes in the sea than him. So I broke off the relationship. About a year later, she was paralyzed. In an automobile accident and died, and I've carried some of that for a while. That probably fueled some of my drinking, some guilt around that. Even though I wasn't involved, I broke off a relationship in which I knew she absolutely loved me and I loved her. I just didn't have self-centered fear was the problem. At college, were in a dorm, and it was all transfer students. They called us the Dirty 30. We were actually quite miraculous. We had the best grades on campus. We beat out all. We weren't trying. We were just guys that had tried at one place. We were half vets. I roomed with a Marine sergeant that did firefights and everything. And we're half vets and half transfer students. Where this is what we got to make it. This is our last stand right here. And because we had great grades, the college thought that they would put in a pub, a bar downstairs, and they put in ping pong tables and everything. And we had to supply the beer. So every Friday night and every Saturday night, this is where my drinking progresses to all out on the weekend. We would get rip, roaring drunk. None of us really dated. We had so much fun with ourselves. It was a great group of guys. When I graduated, I didn't know what the hell I wanted to do. I was a history major, and my father worked for a manufacturing company that made accessories. And my brother had been gone in. He started out at Yale Divinity. He ended up running this factory when my father retired. They liked him. And so the president approached me and said, we'd like to have you look in the sales end. Would you like to do it? And I said, well, I don't think I could do sales because I can't lie to people. Now you know a little bit more about Carl. He said, you don't have to lie. So I went to New York to observe a market there, and then the Texas sales rep, he was actually the sales manager, asked me to come down to Texas. So Texas was the last place I wanted to be, but I said, well, I'll try it for a year and see what happens. In Texas, I found out later on that I was in an alcoholic sales office. That was many years later I realized that when I got into AA, I started to look at the personalities I worked with. And the boss was a full-blown alcoholic. He had lost his brother. He'd lost his father to the disease. And he had a personality that was the most warm personality, the most women who went crazy, Mr. Blue Eyes. But when he had a couple of drinks, or if he came in the morning after in withdrawal, the whole office went silent. They went and hid. They hide it too, I tell you. It was that kind of, and I never got criticized. I was always complimented because I liked selling. I liked working with my customers, and the figures just started climbing. And so I was around a very intense environment, much like my childhood home. I never thought about that until this moment. Anyway, we get back to the drink. He wouldn't keep beer in the refrigerator, which was my favorite. All they drank was scotch, and I did not like the taste of scotch. So I put a lot of water in it at first, and then over a period of time, I didn't put any water in it. And that's before we left the office. And in Texas in those days, you could put your drink in your car, your little holder there, and drive home. I lived in an apartment. I would start fixing my... I was real proud of myself because I bought pots and pans, and I made my own meals, did my own shopping, and I'd have 3 beers. That was about it. But on the weekend, I had a buddy who was going to Texas, University of Texas Medical School. And he was going to go out to have pizza, then we'd go out to the pubs, and pitcher after pitcher of beer, first at the pizza place, and now you're warmed up, you're ready for that dart game. I don't know how we hit the board, but we wanted darts a number of times, and he was my drinking buddy. I was very successful. I was the road man, the freighter for the company. I'd go out to West Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma. And I was a low man on the totem pole when I started. They're all much older men who were accomplished, and I was a new kid on the block. And if I don't get to this, when I left and asked for my own territory, which ended up being the Southeast, we owned that territory. I would literally call people and say, I'm coming out behind so-and-so, and they'd say, don't worry, Carl, we're staying in the business. I had a lot of respect from the people I worked with. I was very patient with them, and I was very respectful to them. in spite of my drinking, it hadn't taken full-blown effect to me by that time. On my road trips, it was very common for me to get two or three beers. I never went out. I had too much work to do. I'd come into a town. I'd work early in the town, try to get to the next town, get some of the work done there, all out of a truck or a car, sample cases and everything. And I'd drive either to the next town and be ready for the next morning. And I needed to be alert. So two or three beers. They did get to 16-ounce beers near the end. Let me kick this up a notch. As I said, the territory was growing very successfully. And about 1977 or 78, my wife wanted me to see a psychiatrist because the drinking was on the weekends was way out of control. We didn't have any children at that time, and I just worked hard and put Carl to bed wet. I didn't have a life. I did have part of life. I was had a catamaran sailboat, and every weekend I'd be out on that boat, and I had a 6'4" Texas buddy, and he'd buy a case, and I'd be up by a case, and we'd do the weekend sailing and everything. And then when I got married, it was more lawn, do the lawn and everything, and I'd try to wait till 5 o'clock, but there was a lot of drinking in the evenings. And about 76, 77, I drove into a telephone pole with my new Saab. And my wife said, I think you need to see a psychiatrist, because I was talking about suicide. Part of it, I think, was the office environment, that intimidation, and self-centered fear. What happens when I don't perform? I don't know whether it's so much the second part, because I was still performing and everything looked good, but I went to see a psychiatrist who was a crackpot. If I don't get this, I became a licensed clinical social worker 1 year after. Went to school for it and became one. It's kind of, you always look for an organic source to a problem. Is somebody putting something in that might change their behavior? Well, this guy said, young man, he said, you've been hunting squirrel and rabbit. And he said, now you're ready. You need to hunt bear and wild game, big wild game. So I suggest you get your own territory. Do we hear a geographical fix coming in here? Becky said to him, you know, he has a drinking problem, I think. He's talking about suicide and he's been drinking a lot. He never addressed that problem. So it was about a 2-year wait. I asked my sales manager if I could have the Southeast versus the Midwest, the Rust Belt. I figured this is a great place to raise my children. And so I got it, but I had a 2-year wait. And when I came over here, I worked with a man. I didn't know why the sales Southeastern figures were so low until I really got to know the personality of what would be my partner for 2 years. It was a transition period, and the customers hated him. Enough about him. When I came over here, the schedule was much different from the one in Texas, where I was probably gone 10 or 12 weeks a year. I was gone 26 weeks and weekends a year. And the first year we doubled the figures. The next year we did another half on that. And I was kind of everything to everybody. I knew it was going to be mine when I finished. So, but the drinking increased. A lot of it was contained by me having to work that much. But when I did come home, I was usually exhausted. I didn't have a life. You've heard the script, 26 weeks. And we did have children at that time, very young children. And I don't want you to think the worst. I mean, we went to Six Flags. We were in a condominium, so we had a pool. And I taught them to swim, and I taught them to ride the bikes. And I didn't really do the drinking until after 5, but then it was Dad's time. But when I came home, it was about Dad getting his needs met. And an example would be they would be down in the kitchen. I haven't seen my children in weeks. They'd be down in the kitchen playing a board game or something, and I'd be up in the living room or on the patio drinking my alcohol, trying to come down from that intensity that I'd been at. So, to make a long story short, I was emotionally unavailable to my children and pretty much physically unavailable to my children. That's an ouch. As far as my drinking and its effect on the family, that's part of it. Becky and I, she was my secretary, and the alcohol was blurring everything. I came home and I was still the executive, telling her what we need to do, and she was raising my children. She was a secretary, and she was doing everything that I wasn't doing. My job was to climb the ladder and bring in the income, and everything was, if I attained or achieved something, everything would be fine for Carl and his family. And I was very conscientious about that, but the alcohol was the only way I had for an escape. About 1988, even I was becoming aware that at 5 o'clock I'd go to the fridge. First thing I did was go to the refrigerator, get the beer, come down from the day. And that led to another, and my personality would change, and I would be having verbal fights with Becky. The verbal fights persisted, and counseling was suggested. So we went to marital counseling. And a psychologist, I think it was a psychiatrist at that time, said, I want you in AA, and I want you in Al-Anon, otherwise I won't work with you. Thank God for ethical therapists. So I went to AA, and I went there because I was ordered, not because I thought I was alcoholic. And I went there for about 30 days, and I got a sponsor. This guy, no, I didn't. I went there for, I got a sponsor. And I called him one day, and I said, he called me at the office. He said, I haven't seen you around Skyland. I said, well, I think I can control my drinking. I'll never forget these words. This is the intuition of somebody who's been there and done that. He said, Carl, he said it very lovingly, not critically. He said, Carl, look at the things you have in your life today, because in 6 months, they may not be there. And it was 5.5 months later, my wife said, I'm leaving you with the children. And it was just pulling out the driveway. Actually, she went. And I said, I've got to look at this alcoholism, and I admitted myself to Charlie Peachford. And part of the old behavior, I'm in there, and I got some downtime, so I'm on the phone and calling my clients. I said, Mr. L, what are you doing? And I said, there's not a group going on right now, so I've got work to do. They said, you're in here because you're sick. What a concept. I didn't know the degree of sickness I had. I've learned it through your experiences. But it wasn't just about a chemical. It was the whole person. I was spiritually dead. I didn't know what spirituality was. I lived to work and worked to drink, basically. So anyway, I went through charter, and they had a session. The last session was a counseling session with my wife and myself. And she said, well, what do you think of your husband? Do you see a change? Never forget these words. Oh, yeah, I see a change, but this is like Disney World in here. In other words, she didn't trust the change would stay fixed. She said, when he leaves here, he's in an apartment. He's not coming back in the house. And there was no guarantee that our marriage would be back together. It's unfortunate, but it's good in a way. I've looked back at this, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me was her kicking me out of my house and putting a value judgment, drawing a line in the sand and saying, choose your family or the alcohol. Let me just collect my thoughts here for a minute. It's unfortunate, but it's useful that when we're trying to stay sober, that all of the things that the alcohol, our alcoholism, has affected, all the mistrust, all the hurt, all the problems surface when we get sober. And we've got to stay sober when all these things are all this chaos is going on in our lives, and it wants to pull us. My thing was, I wanted to call my wife every evening, and I said, I want to say goodnight to the children. My sponsor pointed out, he said, did you ever say goodnight to your children? He said, you're probably doing what I'm doing. You're trying to feel out the environment, see if you can come back in, if there's going to be a marriage. He said, if your wife's like my wife, she'll realize that you're still trying to control things. That nothing's really changed, you're just not drinking. And if your wife is like my wife, she will recognize that, and she won't have anything to do with you. He said, stop the calling is my suggestion. Come with me to meetings. So I would go to Skyland. He'd pick me up in his little Toyota, and we'd go to Skyland. And he had these little one-liners that were quite beautiful. I didn't have a clue what he meant. And I'd hear these let go and let God, and first things first, and easy does it. And they started to take hold over a period of time. So anyway, it was at Skyland that I started to hear people's stories. I stopped focusing on my marriage and started focusing on what these people had. You had something. I couldn't put my finger on it at the time. Now I can. A serenity, a happiness, a humility, and an honesty. And it was like a magnet to me. I wanted to be around you people. AA was the most comfortable place I've ever found in my life. That's the gut feeling when I started with AA. And so I kept going to AA, and about 7 months later, my wife said to me, I want to start dating you again. It would be some more months before I got bedroom privileges. But I get back in the house, and I started to be more aware of doing the laundry and things that I didn't do. I had more time on my hands since I wasn't drinking. My sponsor, he turned me over to another sponsor. And the other sponsor he turned me over to was because he had young children too and similar experiences. He said, I want to go through the steps with you. I want you to make your amends by Christmas time when your family comes down here. Be a good opportunity. And I did that. I'm jumping ahead, but the fourth step for me, the first one I wrote was quite beautiful. The problem was it put me as a victim. So we used the form, which I do recommend today. It keeps the writing down and the truth up. And I realized I had my own column where I was to blame. That shift in perspective was the beginning of a new perception about me and people I loved, and where part of the problem was, it wasn't just in the alcohol, it was in my character. And the other part of that fourth step, what were your fears? It would be some period of time before I realized the importance of self-centered fear in all of my character defects, or my basic personality, my responding style to everything, and how closely linked that was with alcohol. Anyway, I'm going to drop back one time because this has to do with part of the second and third step. This new sponsor, I would call before I got back in the house and say, Bruce, I know this is going to happen. I know she's going to tell me she doesn't want me back. So he said, well, Carl, will you promise me you'll do two things tonight? I said, what's that? He said, don't act on it and don't take a drink and we'll talk to me tomorrow. Well, that went on for many, and I realized that when I didn't take a drink and I didn't act on, I call them the tapes, rapid, rigid, repetitive, negative thoughts. The more I play them, the faster they go until I want to act on them. That things were getting better. That what I thought was going to happen absolutely wasn't happening. And I started to have this little increment of belief or faith that I might be the problem right here. So anyway, I got back home and everything, and let me shift up to my children. I told my sponsor, I said, I don't know how to be a father. And he said, Carl, he said, it's really quite simple. I said, what do you mean? He said, just give your children what you get at AA. And I said, what's that, Bruce? He said, you show up for others and for yourself, but you show up, you listen, you don't interrupt people. When it's your turn, you share only from your own experience. And if they want a hug, you can give them a hug. I gave my son a hug, and then over a period of a week, the hug came back. I gave my daughter a hug, and the hug came back. Both of my children had, they call it reading disorders. 1 year into sobriety, the reading disorders miraculously disappeared because the angst in the home caused by the alcoholic was gone. Becky and my relationship, the trust that had been, the mistrust stayed there for some time. I would get looks like, I think you're going to revert. And the wounds, those things did not heal overnight. There wasn't a lot of intimacy. It wasn't bad, it just wasn't warm. Because I think she lived in fear. Is this thing going to last? She went to Al-Anon and didn't stick. So my job was, if she's not going to Al-Anon, my program's going to kick in big time. Over a period of years, the children. Both of those children were involved in sports. My daughter in softball, my son in baseball, football, track and field, you name it, wrestling. And when I got sober, I showed up at all their events. And before the game, I give them a hug. And after, I give them a hug. I'll never forget a wrestling match that my son was in the final with. My son was, he was good, but the coaching where he was wasn't as good as the coaching in other places. And the other guy had been injured, and he didn't want to wrestle. He wanted to forfeit the match to the other guy because he didn't want to hurt the other. And I said, Eric, I said, you go out and win, but try not to hurt him. And I gave him a hug, and he did not hurt the person. He was very, could see him. Anyway, that's my son. About 10 years ago, I wanted to kick our marriage up to another notch. And Becky didn't want to go to marital therapy, but she said she'd go to individual therapy. Without getting into a lot of detail, she was wounded by a previous marriage at a very young age, and those scars didn't heal too well. She also lived with an alcoholic, yours truly, for 20 years, and that sure didn't help things. But anyway, she was willing to go get individual therapy, and I went and got some individual therapy. And I had become 1 year into sobriety, I started to share this. I wanted to get off the road. I wanted to be home for my children. I wanted to be part of a family. And I also wanted to either sell a product or provide a service that would help people. So in that 1 year, a lot of things happened through those 12 steps. I went to UGA, got my master's, and became a licensed clinical social worker, working in a facility. I don't know where I've lost my track here, but I said that for a reason. I knew that her therapist, being a codependent she was, would help her address some issues she hadn't addressed with me, which were my character defects playing out in the home, not picking up everything. It's like, if you see it, pick it up, you know? Not being able to work a computer and coming to her. She worked in the other bedroom. We both worked out of the home, and helped me with this. And arguing with the commentators on the news. Those behaviors I didn't think were able to, in tantrums on the phone with the home office. I remember telling my spouse, I said, Bruce, I said, what are you, perfect? How do you control your tantrums? He said, I don't have them in front of my loved ones. But when I read those seven character defects, basically, I didn't say, oh, it's gray area or something like that. I said, it doesn't make a damn what I feel. This is what she feels, and this is what she wants changed. And I said a prayer, and I said, let's go get them. Those went away, those character defects. The marriage, all I can tell you is there was intimacy. Some years ahead, I had made a decision that I basically got what I wanted in bed. And I'm not talking about intimacy. I'll get to the other intimacy in a minute. But I made a decision that I was going to let go and let God in the bedroom where I had always taken. I was going to be a giver. And let's just say that made her happy and that made me happy. As far as the new intimacy, I would grab her hand going into the supermarket, where I never grabbed her hand. We would hug. There was a warmth that had never been there before. So something intuitively in me said, let's kick it up a notch, and we took it to that level. About 3 years ago, my wife had a collapsed lung, and I took her down to Piedmont, and they said she had a small cell lung cancer on her bronchial tube, and they hit it with radiation, they hit it with chemo, but being small cell cancer, you don't make it out of the woods with that. She didn't know that at the time, I don't suspect, and I kept it from her. I didn't really know it at the time. The doctor told me it's not hopeless, but it's less than 50% chance at that point. By November of, that was in January, by November of 08, she had a scan, and they hadn't picked it up. It had gone to her brain and metastasized in four places, and also went to her ovaries, and they had to work on her brain first. So she did 13 sessions of whole brain radiation to kill everything and to reduce the size of the tumors, and then they'd go back and hit them with gamma knife radiation. 1 month before that, she lost her job. First wave of the economic slowdown, 618, and she was one of them. So her income went in half. Then in November, the diagnosis. And the market also decided to play a game with our retirement, which we both spent a lot of time building up. It went to less than half. So I was in a quite overwhelmed. There were three things I had absolutely no control of. Went to the park one day. There's a lake inside the perimeter, Murphy Canyon Lake. Went over there and I got quiet. This is where I finally worked the 11th step. And I've skipped some part about the amends, but I wanted to share it about the family being there, and rather than get into my mother and my father, I basically started calling my mother and my father every week because I didn't call them. And they got cards where they never got cards. They got hugs. A hug I got outside of Skyline one night has been all over the freaking place in my family. Now we all hug. And when my son was on the football game at Marist before the game, there were about 10 of them, 10 of the jocks that get together and hug each other. So that one hug's been around a lot of places. It's actually won some games. So I went to the lake and I got quiet and I realized that these were three things I couldn't control. And that was the beginning of my gratitude prayer that I do to this day. Every morning when I leave the early morning study, I go to the lake and do a gratitude prayer. And you might say, well, why gratitude? One day I went over there, it was very early on, and I said, never about results, I learned, don't ask for results. I said, God, please support Becky. And the answer came back, I am Carl, you're it. And that would begin a two and a half year cycle of increasing caretaking for Becky. That I think Tim mentioned God. Every morning I go to the lake after the meeting, get myself my well filled up at the meeting, and then go to the lake and do a gratitude prayer for the resources that were coming in, the insurance, and the kind of doctors that were being put in front of her. She actually ended up with one of the top two oncologists. Just walked in the door. The old Carl would have been going everywhere trying to control things and find out who's the best doctor. I found out later he was one of the top two oncologists in the city. When she had the surgery on her brain to take out one of the tumors, the one at this hospital didn't want to do it. He said, she'll die, I think. So as we're walking out of the door dejected, he said, call this man, Dr. Olson at Emory, which told me this is the dude. He got it out. The only problem was the other tumor came back. But getting back to the lake, I would do a gratitude prayer because I was always the self-centered fear. Everything was negative. And I found that by doing that simple prayer, the things that I had in my life and the resources that were flowing in, and thank you, Mary Ann. You think it was a small thing. Mary directed us to a lawyer for a disability. And I don't know that Paul M's here from the early morning study, but Paul came over and worked as the intermediary on the insurance contact. Becky couldn't, was in insurance, but she cognitively wasn't there, and I couldn't comprehend the stuff. It was so heavy. People came out of the woodwork out of this program to help me. And all the little comments, love, and support. But each morning I go to Senate at the lake, and I just start going about what I needed to do. And part of that was running my business, and the other part was an increasingly caretaking for Becky, to the point at the end of giving her shots. And she went diabetic, and cleaning her up, and the bed, and doing the cooking, and the laundry, and everything else. The miracle was this. I had an energy that wouldn't give up. Physical energy. I don't know. I do know how. I had a serenity through all of this. I was the calm one, dealing with all the doctors and everything. And I was happy. And that's not believable. But it's absolutely true. And I attribute it to my morning meeting, the love that was being poured out on me. And I was able to pour it out on Becky, and the love from my higher power that being centered in whatever was in front of me. I couldn't afford to not do it then. I had to do it. And I stayed busy. That thing, don't just sit around doing nothing. When Becky passed, she passed January 16th. Just before she passed, we brought her home for 2 weeks. I learned this in AA too from the guy that gave me my first hug when his father died. We had her in the living room, and people would come and they ended up chatting with each other because Becky was kind of semi there. And when they all left, I'd say, Becky, would you like a concert tonight? And she'd kind of smile. That's all I got. So she loved Andre Bocelli. And I would crawl up in the bed with her and put on Andre Bocelli. And when she fell asleep, I'd go to bed. Intuition. Gary N. told Michael T. to call me one morning because I wasn't at the early morning study. I was getting ready to come to the early morning study, and that's when Becky passed. Spiritual stuff. Now I'm in. I'm going to try and wrap this up right now because I know I'm already over. But a lot's happening now. I've got to reinvent Carl. I've got to get on with my life. I have a new grandbaby that was born 1 month after Becky's memorial service. And he fills up the old heart. My buddies have been grandfathers, and I know what they're feeling. I have another buddy in here. His name is Grady. Grady came to me after Becky passed, and he said, I know you're not ready for this now, Carl. But he said, when you're ready, I will I'll basically help you get out and socialize. And I called Grady about 2 months ago, and I'm getting ready to join a seniors group. And thank you, Grady. My tendency when you go through a crisis is to go to the old way of responding. My thing is sit home. My son said to me months ago, what are you doing to enjoy yourself, Dad? I said, I'm content, Eric. He said, I didn't say content, meaning serene. He said, I said enjoy. Because I was sitting on my patio listening to oldies and just nothing, having a good day and everything. I've made a decision not to date anybody for a year. To me, it's like the first year in sobriety. You can hurt others if you're still sick and needy. I still miss Becky. And I don't want to hurt another human being because I'm not totally content with myself. So the social aspect of getting out there with a group will work for me. I found out I like to dance. And I'll share this with you. We went to a senior's dance. Grady again. This is program stuff. He said, Carl, most of the women out there are going to be much older than you. You're at the low end of the spectrum because of your early loss. I opened the door and I literally stood there and said, is this the stage of life that I'm at? It was a shock. But Grady had said to me, Jarl, he said, these women, this is the highlight of their month. He said, Carl, they just want to be held. Now, if it had been me and I'd been drinking, I would have looked in that room and said, nothing in here for me. But I remembered that. And I danced with just about every woman out there. And some of them were older than dirt, with all due respect. Two women. I'm going to wrap.
Yeah.
I'll wrap this up in an hour or two. Two older women there, I really felt if I spun them around, you know, that they'd probably fall down or something. So I'm ready to spin them, and I said, brace yourself, I'm going to spin you now. I came back from that dance, and I processed it. What would have been if I had stayed at home? What would have been if I had stayed in the seat or not even gone in the room? I had a wonderful time. I didn't go there to get what I wanted. I didn't want to come home with another woman. But they're all older. You know, I expected some women my age in there. Or more my age. But I got what I needed. And here's the kicker. My sense of humor hasn't been around for months. It kicked in big time that night. It was very free-floating. And I said, Carl, that's because you're around people who are enjoying themselves. What I've been trying to say is everything I have, and I'm happy today, and I'm serene, and I'm going to keep moving because I've got buddies in here that care a lot about me. And I'm trusting my higher power. I came through that crisis realizing one thing, that I came through it happy, serene, and still alive, and still loving. And that made me reflect on why, and the why, and why I can go forward and never have to pick up a drink, no matter what it is. It's God. I got you people at my side, and I got my higher power at my back. And alcohol, for this alcoholic, can't do anything for the tin man that the tin man doesn't already have. And thank you for providing me with myself and a way of life that just beyond comprehension, no matter what. That's about it.
Thank you, Carl. Now, Carl gave up a two-step dance lesson tonight to give us a 12-step lesson. So, I want to thank you. That was beautiful. I'm sure everybody feels the same way. We're going to pass the basket again. Sorry to double dip you, but if you were late coming in, or if you were distracted and didn't see the basket, Tenza's going to help me with this. We're having a very hard time meeting our expenses, so anything that you can do to help, we'd like to keep this program going for you. And I've asked Frank to give out the chips.
That's Mike Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And here at this meeting, they have a chip system unlike any other place in Atlanta. They have a white chip for those of you that want to try this, have a desire to stop drinking, and want to give it a shot 1 minute at a time. Maybe you can make it 1 day at a time. Does anybody want to pick up a white chip? Come on up here, honey. Anybody else? Don't lie. Just come on up here. All right. Anybody have a silver chip for 30 days and nights in a row? Anybody have 30 days? We have a red chip for 90 days, 3 months. Anybody need a red chip? Okay. We have a yellow chip for 6 months. Anybody need one of these? Does anybody want one? Okay. We have a green chip for 9 months. It is the green chip because it's green. That's exactly right. Anybody need a green chip? We have a blue chip for years or multiples of years. That means more than 1 year, like 2, 3, 4, whatever. You know, I had a hard time processing that when I first came in. Like, what does that mean, multiples of years? So does anybody need a blue chip tonight? Does everybody in here have a chip? Yeah. Congratulations on the chips you hold.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. And now it's time for AA-related announcements. Anybody like to share? We've been going at it a while, but I'll try to be brief. There's a NAVA membership special that's good through September the 30th. Tonight is the 27th. If you pay a year's membership in full, you can get it for $200. If you were paying monthly, your annual NAVA membership would add up to $300 per year. Or if you're an Al-Anon member, your special rate is only $120 per year. This offer lasts until September 30th. Your membership is also tax deductible. And if you have fallen off for a few months. If you get in on this special, any back dues will be forgiven. So that's really a great opportunity to do a lot for yourself and for Napa. We also have a golf tournament coming up. There's things on the board about that. It's at Mystery Valley. That generates pretty good income for the club, or has historically. Now, there's also, if you don't play golf, there's a raffle associated with that, and it's $10 for a ticket. $5 goes to NAVA, $5 goes in the pot, and at the golf tournament, they're going to pick the winner. Last year, there was a $400 prize. So $10 donation, and you could get it back in spades. So that's a good thing.
Halloween dance.
Halloween dance? Yes. Details?
I'm about the Halloween dance.
Wear a costume. Saturday night in here right after the 12 and 12 meeting.
Pretty costume.
The weekend of Halloween, I guess, or closest to Halloween. All right. Next week, there's a gentleman by the name of Gordon C. Yep. If you come to the 5:45 or 11 o'clock meeting, you see him frequently. Just a very unique individual that gets his sobriety is infectious. He just cracks me up. So hope you enjoy him. And then the week after that, we have Tom S., who's going to be a visitor from the Wednesday night men's group around Roswell, Georgia. So they have fantastic sobriety in that group. So he'll bring a lot to the podium, and that will be it, unless anybody else has an announcement. Okay. I'd like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions that remind us to place principles before personalities, and for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Thank you very much.
Hey, Angela.
Julie, would you take us out, please?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Can I sign these for you?
Yeah. I think you always want to
let me get a pen.
This morning.
I'm good.
How about you?
Good to see you.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you.